Professor April McMahon is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. April is the Deputy Vice Chancellor for Education and Professor of English Language and Linguistics at the University of Kent. We talk about being born in Edinburgh while a Beatles concert was taking place. She speaks candidly about how there weren't many opportunities open to her as a child, how her mother had to work hand to mouth. Reading books from the library van was April's passion. She talks about being into the New Romantics, Clare Grogan and Altered Images, being a sucker for musicals. We find out whether she is a Braveheart or a Gregory's Girl type of person. She recounts what inspired her to go to university and the false start when she initially chose to do English literature rather than language, and we find out what happened at her first lecture. She talks about the teachers that inspired her. She grew up at a time when there was constant friction between London and Scottish politics. She talks about how she has never been a party member and will make decisions on the basis of issues. She talks about how her personal Christian faith came along when she was in her mid-30s. Radio played a role in April's growing up, and she remembers listening to Junior Choice on Saturday mornings and how she would do her school homework while Radio 1 was on in the background. We talk about how her memories are mixed due to her mother dying suddenly while she was at university. And April talks about whether she tends to look forwards or backwards and why she believes there is no point in dwelling on times that weren't good, but that it is important to enjoy the present. So welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. My guest this week is April McMahon. Well, it's my absolute pleasure to have April McMahon here. And also you're the
Deputy Vice-Chancellor for Education.
Yeah. And you've been here for about a couple of years now, isn't it?
Yeah, nearly. Two and a half years, nearly three, therefore,
Wonderful. So, absolute pleasure to be here in the registry and speaking to you this afternoon. But can you tell me a little bit about your background, sort of when and where you were born?
I can. So, I was born in Edinburgh, and that was in 1964, which is a very good year, during a Beatles concert. Well, I wasn't at it, if you see what I mean, but it was happening when my mother was giving birth in the maternity hospital. And I remember this because I always grew up with her saying, everybody was screaming in Edinburgh that night. So she clearly felt very much part of proceedings.
I like that sort of idea because a colleague of mine, Jeremy Corrette, he got married on the day of an Elton John concert in Canterbury, and during the reception in the evening we could hear all the screaming, and of course obviously we were all delighted that Jeremy was married, but of course we're also aware that the Elton John concert was taking up a lot of the routes to and from the city, so it was sort of funny to have that sort of historical episode. I guess it's like the equivalent of somebody being born at Woodstock, during Woodstock.
Yeah.
But the Beatles is pretty close.
Yes, not bad, and very much of its time.
Yeah. And what about your parents? What did they do?
My dad was not really around. He had jobs here and there. We spent a lot of time. This is the miserable bit. We'll get the miserable bit over with first. So we spent a lot of time when I was quite small, going and waiting to meet him, because he'd said he would come and meet us, and he never came, or very rarely, So I remember that absence rather than presence, if you see what I mean. It's an odd thing. He had another family, as it turned out. We didn't know about that at the time, and he was an alcoholic, which is sort of a profession in its own right. I think, really, you have to be quite committed. But my mother and I were quite a neat little unit, and my sister, when I was small, she's 14 years older than me, and she must have been deeply vexed having this tiny person suddenly, when she was just at high school and learning to do her own thing and wanting to be with her friends, and there was me trundling along just learning to walk. So that must have been, deeply vexing.
But you do find that in families, don't you, sometimes when there's an age gap particularly, and one of the siblings will take a leadership role, and it's not always the case that follows through into later life, because sometimes happens in the case of my family. I have a cousin, and it sort of very much changed as they got older. One of the younger siblings then almost took on that same leadership role, but it does happen, particularly when you have a background that isn't always, as stable as one would like.
Yeah. So my sister got married when I was 6, 7, something like, must have been 7. And I remember being a bridesmaid and having a little yellow frock, and That was all very exciting. And then she was away from home after that, so it was me and my mum basically. And mum had a sort of interesting history, in that she had the choice. She was going to go on and do her leaving certificate at school, and she was very smart, my mother. And then the war broke out, Second World War, and she was given the choice: do you want to stay and do your leaving certificate, Irene, or will you go with your brothers and sisters and be evacuated? Because they lived in a part of Edinburgh that was down by the docks. It was going to be pretty susceptible to enemy action. So they said, you can go and look after your little brothers and sisters. And what was she going to do? So like a lot of young people at that time, her education kind of stopped dead when she was about 14, 15. And she looked after the little ones. And she went back into work, but it was very much hand-to-mouth stuff, really. She cleaned people's houses, took great pride in doing it, but that was what she did. And then she worked in a factory, and she was kind of keeping things together to keep things going for me, really, as time went on, I guess, you know. So expectation-wise, it's sort of wrong side of the tracks, except you don't know where the tracks are when you're growing up, really, do you? So
no, and in a way, you forge your own path. But I'm guessing as well that sometimes with that sort of beginning, you're very much more aware of how important it is to shape whatever path you take, rather than have one sort of set out for you. Because I don't think I've interviewed anybody as part of this series who has said it was all laid out for me. I knew exactly where I was going to go. I knew which profession I was going to enter. And so there were sort of all these open doors. That isn't people's experience. And of course, it's hard work that comes from having to sort of say, well, this isn't necessarily the life I would have chosen, but we all have ambitions. And sometimes we are lucky enough to be able to reach those goals.
Well, I think that's right. And you don't actually, you know, you said there were all these open doors. I mean, I didn't know where the doors were, you know.
So what would you say that you enjoyed doing as a child?
Well, when I was very small, we were in Edinburgh. We were in the city, lived in a flat. That there weren't all that many opportunities to go out and do. It was very urban, you know. I'm trying to think, apart from reading, which was absolutely the passion from, you know, the earliest age, really, I can't remember not reading, and would voraciously go through things it was the library van that came round. There wasn't a library that we could get to from where we lived very easily. We didn't have any transport, but there was a library van that came round, and you would take books out from there. So I can remember doing that, and that was brilliant. Then after the end of primary school, we moved down to the Scottish borders to be near some of my mother's family. And there was a little bit more that you could do in terms of out and about, you know, and at least walking and so on. Gradually cycling, and helped out with horses as well, actually. My uncle and aunt ran a riding school, so did a little bit more of at least the token outdoorsy things. But what I really liked was getting my nose stuck in a book.
and certainly sport was something that I had family members who were either participants or spectators, but that really wasn't my upbringing at all. I had zero interest in anything sporty. No. But I used to almost, well, I wouldn't say pray for rain, but if it was a Thursday and it was a sports day at school and we would due to have games at, say, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then if the rain was falling, I used to think, well, great, I can stay indoors a bit longer, maybe actually do something a bit more reading related.
Yes, I was not motivated by school sports at all. I remember, I mean, at primary school, we didn't have a pitch or anything, you know, there was just a kind of paved yard. But at high school, the horrors of hockey on a Friday morning in November, it just didn't do anything for me at all. We did some Scottish country dancing, it being a Scottish school, and I did enjoy that and carried on doing that when I went to university. So there was at least a bit of physical activity going on, and I remember organising in my sixth form a 24-hour five-a-side football tournament for charity. And that was just miserable. I thought, why did we not do dancing? At least there would have been some pleasure in that. But we did it. We raised some money.
But it's funny, isn't it, that the things that sometimes, from a young age, that particularly motivate us or don't in the case of sports, kind of carry through. And there's almost an authenticity there that sometimes you just know that team, in my case, it might have been rugby or football, just wasn't my sort of thing. But often we were very much defined by our sporting attributes at school. And I think it took me many years to realise that I had a different sort of contribution, but a no less worthy one.
No, that's right. I do remember this misery of always being picked last. For sports teams, thinking, you know, there's no point in even worrying about this. It's just how life is. Yeah. But then again, if there was a quiz or something, I would be picked first for that. So there were compensations.
Yeah, and I feel now in later years, because I've always kept a diary as well, and so being able to map some of those non-sporting interests, shall we say, but with some of the things I do now, and I can see this continuum, you know, writing down whether it was the charts on a Sunday or, you know, particular musical influences that I had. And I think keeping a record of those makes me realise that, you know, if I had my time again, I don't think I would really make any different choices.
It's interesting, isn't it? I don't think I would either. I certainly wouldn't seek to cultivate an interest in sport that I didn't really have. Although I can cheerily watch sport, but just not think to participate.
Because one of the things that interested me was, in a non-sporting sense, very much what my friends and I would be talking about in the school playground on a Monday in relation to the charts and the music that we'd listen to over the course of the weekend. And that was a really wonderful way of defining ourselves. Our identity was often very much forged by how we apprehended particular pieces of music, and whether our friends were close or more distant was very much based on the different ways in which we would take stock of particular types of music and the way in which it very much defined both in the background and perhaps, you know, were very much at the very centre of our emerging identities. And was that a similar experience for yourself?
It was very much. And I mean, I remember this would be, you know, the late 70s, very early 80s, and definitely being up the new romantic end, you know, that I was very taken by that sense of style and subverting fashion, you know, in a really interesting way. Not that we could afford to do that. I mean, I was doing my first Saturday job at the time in a baker's shop, and you just about had enough money for the frilly shirt. But there wasn't any, it wasn't the kind of environment where you would be able to go out in the way that you would have been able to in a city context. I don't think I'd have been attracted to doing that anyway, to be honest. But that sense that, you were definitely someone who was more interested in Ultravox and not interested in punk, and they could keep their safety bins, you know.
But it was very, I mean, I was about 7 or 8 around 1981, and I do remember that there were those people who were really into Adamant, those into Bad Manners, those into Madness, those into Bucks Fizz. But it was such a constellation, such a coalescence of different musical styles. And you mentioned Ultravox, and of course, wasn't that voted a few years ago by Radio 2 the greatest song never to have reached number one in the charts? And it was Joe Dolce's I Shut Up In Your Face. That is shocking. And some people still bear the scars, you know, 38 years on.
but you're right. And yet it was a bit of a melting pot. I mean, I was very interested in all of that, but I was also listening to Blondie, and I was listening to ABBA, and I was listening to, you know, gradually those kind of earlier American standards where you can feel the influences coming through some of that music, you know, and going back to Ella Fitzgerald and so on, and starting to learn about where popular music, if you like, had actually come from. And I remember that being fascinating.
And that's often the sign of coming of age, doesn't it? When you're not just interested in what you heard on the radio the day before, which might be chart music, but when you then go back further and discover other styles. And for me at university, it was that juxtaposition of the latest sounds, although I was far less interested. By the time I was 18 or 19, I really didn't care what was in the charts. arts, and I was very much interested in different generations' music. My parents' generation, for example. So Radio 2 in those days was very much playing music that I didn't have the opportunity to grow up with. It was very much somebody else's generation. But I think having that at the same time as being aware of what other people my age were listening to just meant that, at least musically and culturally, I felt that I was growing up and sort of working out that, irrespective of what other people were interested in, I had my own style and quite an eclectic mix, and that's very much stayed with me all these decades on.
And I think that's one of the things, is figuring out, if I like this and I like this, then what else am I going to like? You see it as an opportunity. And I remember finding that I really loved musicals. Actually, I'm a sucker for a musical, you know, I'll sit through anything. But I remember winning a public speaking competition, and the prize was to go and compete in the UK sort of final in London. And the team and I, none of us had ever been to London. We, you know, where was that? I don't know if I could have found it on a map. And it would have been about just before GCSE kind of age. And my English teacher, who was a big influence on me, said, right, we're going to go to the theatre, we're going to go to a musical, and we went to see Evita, Julie Covington, and it was just fantastic. And that has left a real impression, you know, that to hear these thoughts expressed musically in a way that, you know, it's a play basically with some of the parts are a song, and it's just, it's brilliant. That just stayed with me, and that's still a real love.
Yeah, I only went to the musical theatre the first time. I think it was in 2010. I remember it was about the night before the general election, and I saw Oliver. And I couldn't believe that prior to that, I'd been to pantomimes when I was very young, but it was always cinema rather than the theatre that particularly enthused me. And it may have been the price to an extent, because obviously the cost of a West End theatre ticket, you could be talking £60 or more pounds, and not always for the best seats. Whereas at the cinema, you're paying a lot less. But I do think that there's something about that interactive experience when you're watching the actors on stage, in some cases moving the sets about. Jersey Boys was a good case when they weren't just coming on stage and delivering their lines, but they were very much shaping the furniture. And you could see that as the plot and the characters were developing, so were the costumes, and so was the different pieces of cardboard or furniture, whatever it was, the different props on stage. And it was a very different, a very immersive experience, and something that I'd never really encountered before. And unusually, I think I came away from watching Jersey Boys and wanting to buy the soundtrack, because I wanted to carry a little piece of that evening with me. And it's never quite the same, of course, but that evening was very precious.
But it brings it back, so... Yeah. No, I remember having exactly that experience of trying to find the soundtrack to Evita. And that whole... I guess I am a theatre girl rather than a film girl at the end of the day. And I have no objection to going to the cinema or watching a DVD or whatever at home. And it's a lovely thing. But it's being there and seeing it unfolding in real time. And that sense that... you kind of know what's going to happen, but you don't really. That I really enjoy about the theatre. I remember getting a season ticket when I was in Edinburgh as an undergraduate in my first year, and you could get them for not very much. There must have been some deal done with the Lyceum Theatre. And I just sat through everything in you know, the back stalls on the first Tuesday of every run, the seats you can't sell. And just thrived on the whole thing of watching this massively eclectic, new, old plays, everything, cross-cultural, and it was just brilliant.
Yeah. And that's something I very much found with pantomimes, taking my young children there. And I really found that you'd have a few musical numbers, you'd have a few jokes, you'd have lots of nonsense on stage, but it was the eclectic mix, and it was the sense that the audience were very much part of this that was very precious and very different to anything that a film or a DVD can really accomplish. And I think that, and of course we have a colleague here who is a pantomime dame, and I went to the Village Hall first of all thinking, I'm sure it's going to be good fun, but nothing compared to what, say, the Marlowe Theatre can do. In a way, quite the opposite. It was the lighting was perfect, and I think there was a real intimacy, and because maybe the expectations were very different, because also when you actually know the performers and you see them in a very different guise, you know, you come away thinking, I can never interact with that person in the same way again. It was such a life changing, but also life enhancing experience, and seeing that we all have these alter egos. But but it was a fantastic, and I think having children, young children, is helpful, because it means I can justify doing these things a little bit more.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I've enjoyed talking with that colleague about shoes on a number of occasions. So. But I suppose, I mean, I acted at school and at university a bit, not very well, but I enjoyed it and sang in, you know, musicals, and I still sing in the university chorus. And the thing that I didn't know when I went to university was I know about the kinds of music that I like, and it's all quite modern, but I don't know about classical music. It was a completely closed book to me. And so actually consciously going out to find out, what do I like, and what do I enjoy? Do I enjoy choral music? Well, I guess, as it happens. Do I enjoy modern classical music? Am I a person who likes art galleries, or do I prefer museums? And if I like an art gallery, do I like sculpture, or do I like paintings? I had absolutely no idea. But it can be quite liberating. There's nothing rests on it. Yeah. When you don't know anything, then anything you find out is going to be a bonus, isn't it?
Yeah, and sometimes when you've got different types of music as well, and you know, you find your own way through, and some types of music are not going to be for everybody. But I do find sometimes, though, that, you know, sometimes you can be at a concert, for example, where there's music being played, there may be a band performing, who you remember from when you were young, and suddenly there is something being evoked that we've all grown up. I saw 10cc, for example, on stage, and I was just a little bit too young to remember I'm Not in Love, but seeing them on stage and performing that, and it was sort of a slice of my history, a slice of my childhood nostalgia. And I thought that this is a very memorable evening, because it's almost as though everything has come full circle, that I've gone from almost like growing up from having this on the radio in my bedroom or my Sony Walkman to actually having it on stage with the performers in front of me. And of course I have that sense, I don't know if you do, of sometimes seeing your famous, you know, your childhood hero sometimes, and I just really am so starstruck by that, and I sort of feel, you know, should I ask them for an autograph? They're obviously used to that, but it's making that transition. There's something very intimate sometimes, and music can be very defining. You almost don't want that to be spoiled by suddenly finding that the acts are not how, you know, they don't look or sound or speak or converse in the way that you'd hope that they would.
But it also does just take you back when you get a snatch of music, you know. And I put the TV on. I was waiting for the news to come on the other night. And I don't even know what it was, but there was an advert for a show that was coming on. And there was, I don't know if you remember, Claire Grogan.
Gregory's girl.
Yeah. But altered image, is that right? And so singing I Could Be Happy. Yeah. I thought, oh my Lord. And it really takes you back, because I hadn't heard that for decades, nor would I have gone out of my way particularly to look it up and listen to it, but there it was, and it just gives you that snapshot of yourself.
And there was something about her. She was very boisterous on stage, wasn't she? She's very lively. Yeah. And there was the Happy Birthday song and I Could Be Happy. And I think in many later years, I think she appeared in EastEnders. But and some people obviously associated with Gregory still. Yeah. But you're right that you can't take those images away from your, you know, imagination. So they're very, as you say, you know, very much 1981. I associate that with, I remember the deep snow in the early part of 1982, and I associate that with Altered Images and Claire Grogan, because that was in the charts at the time.
And that was the year I went to university. Yeah. It was 1982, so it's a very salient, you know, kind of period. It's that proper transition point.
And isn't that the question that sometimes Scottish politicians are asked? Are you a Braveheart person, or are you a Gregory's girl?
100%
person.
Gregory's girl.
Yeah, I would answer the same way. Yeah. Very much. I did sit through Braveheart once, I thought I ought to, but no, Gregory's girl made far more of an impression. What inspired you then, April, to enter academia?
It's partly about finding what you're good at. And I found that when I went to school, and I remember, you know, going to nursery, going to school really vividly, and all of these things that you could find out turned out to be pretty good at all that. So although I guess I came from a background where I wouldn't have expected to go on to university, and people routinely didn't from the school that I was at, but there was a little cluster of us in my year who did. And I suppose partly we wanted out of there, and we were very attracted by the idea of, you know, going to university and doing, well, all of these things that you see in sort of fictionalisations, you know, because none of us had any higher education experience, nothing among the lot of us. We had no idea what really happened. But I remember going to an open day in Edinburgh, and sitting in the, what was then the class library, in days when you had a class library, and looking out and thinking, that's it, if I get in here, I'm not going back out there again. Mm. And in a sense, I never have, although I've moved around, I've worked in different universities. And I did my first degree, absolutely loved it, had a bit of a false start, went to do English literature, and nothing against English literature, but it and I just turned out not to be compatible. So I wept through my first lecture, very embarrassing. And I went to see my director of studies, and she said, that's all right, we've seen your sort before, the linguists will have you. And that was that. Went off to do English language and linguistics, absolutely thrived on it. And I guess when I was finishing my first degree, I just didn't feel as if I'd finished asking the questions. So the idea that you could then shape the questions that you could ask and configure that through doing research on the intellectual itch that you particularly wanted to scratch, that was something that really appealed to me. So I wrote some PhD proposals, and it was sensible to stay in Edinburgh because I wanted to work on Scots and Scottish English. Why would you go to another country if you wanted to work on the language of that place? So I stayed and did my PhD, and then I was very, very fortunate and got my first academic job, my first lecturing job, when I hadn't finished my PhD yet. So I almost didn't have to think about it. An opportunity came for somebody to teach in two particular areas, and one was central to my PhD and the other touched on it. And knowing what I know now, I can see them writing this ad and thinking, there isn't anybody who works on these two things, but we'll get somebody who works on one of them, and they'll say they'll bone up on the other one, it'll be fine. My PhD was on the relationship of these two things, so I was just really fortunate.
But it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes the routes that we take, they're not the ones we expected. And what you said about the subject is interesting, because in religious studies, the A-level curriculum is very different to the one that I did, which was very textual, very biblical-based. But students sometimes will do ethics and philosophy at A-level and then do philosophy at university, find that it's not quite what they were hoping for. And so changing discipline, changing subject is quite a commonplace. But actually, that's quite healthy, because it shows that whatever you learn at school, you then find that there are different forms of research that you need to undertake at university in a way you have a different apprehension of your subject. So it's no bad thing if in the first few weeks you say, well, actually, this isn't the right thing for me. Yeah. And you make the change and then thrive, which is obviously what you did all the way to obviously PhD and beyond.
Yeah, no, I absolutely loved it. And when I started teaching myself, you know, when I was doing my PhD, you know, you get asked to do bits and pieces, really, you know, a bit of small group teaching, and I did some sort of helping out, paid teaching for people who, and in those days you had to do English language if you were doing English literature, and some people didn't take to it really, but I could usually get them through, you know, with a few hours of help, and that was fantastic, because it meant I had fewer times that I had to spend doing the genuinely horrible summer jobs that I also needed to do in between.
No, and I've never worked outside the university sector, but that intellectual curiosity, and it's not just intellectual, because, as you know, we were talking earlier about charts and so on, but things that might have been deemed to be trivial when growing up, But the way in which in later years you're able to use that raw material in terms of if you're doing work on community and commitment and faith and values, then very often, you know, many people will talk about the way that a Sunday might be spent very much in church, but also doing lots of other things. I mean, the area that I work in, which is called implicit religion, is very much about that. The idea that we all wear one hat all of the time is simply not true. We always wear multiple hats. We do that professionally, we do that personally. And I think in terms of faith and the intersection between the religious and the secular, very, very important to me. And I think, but that's something that I only really came to in later years when I realised that I was able to shape those questions rather than have it spoon-fed in a way that you say, well, you know, this is one thing or it's something else, but it can't be both and. Yeah. And when I realised that, you know, pretty early on at university, I thought, I think this is the place for me.
Yes. And I don't think you understand at the time how those early influences are playing into that. But having grown up in a family that spoke, you know, Scottish English, it's natural to me to be really curious about why people sound the way they do and why people make the judgments that they do when they hear people who sound in a particular way.
No, and that's an interesting question as well, because I certainly don't sound like so many, well, many of my friends from Cardiff, whom I met when I used to return to Cardiff during my university holiday, I realised didn't sound in the way that I did. And I could never quite work out why that was. And I still don't know to this day. I feel a bit of an enigma sometimes. But maybe I spent so much time listening to the radio, I was not...
that's what you did.
I answered to Ed Stewart too often. But it's interesting, isn't it, that sometimes the way that we interact with people, it's very much something that I found at university with other friends in the first few weeks when they would have accents. I remember a couple of friends from Newcastle upon Tyne and or Rochdale, and I was always having to say, pardon, can you repeat that? And because they felt a bit embarrassed, like, well, you know, and I think it was sort of nervousness on my part that I just met them, but also I was just acclimatising to the different dialect. So even though I was in a very small university in West Wales, the world effectively came to me, and what a wonderful, enriching cultural experience and linguistic experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it all is. And that whole questioning process that you go through, you know, of thinking, so where do I, it's like the tribes thing with the music earlier that we were talking about, you know, where do I fit in? And actually the answer is, in the end, you don't need to fit in anywhere. You build it round yourself.
And were there particular teachers who inspired you, either at school or at university?
Yeah, I mean, lots. You know, we I think it's important that you are asking that question, because for me now, as somebody who really wants to encourage excellence in teaching and education, so many of us in universities, we kind of get our identity through our research. And yet, many of us are here because we've had those really formative experiences working with inspiring teachers. So yeah, my English teacher at school, she was extraordinary. Kind of must have been difficult, guided me through doing what was then called the Certificate of Six-Year Studies. And it was what you did, if you like, if you've got your two A-level years, you do Highers, and then you do what's now called the Advanced Higher, but then it was the Certificate of Six-Year Studies. I was the only one doing it in English. And she had this wonderful light touch where she would just let me gallop off and find things out, and then try and help me to turn that into something that I could also use in exams and in writing a dissertation. But as if that wasn't the whole point of it somehow, that it was just the finding out that really mattered.
Yeah, and sometimes there will be teachers who will say, this is the answer. And I know that sometimes an English teacher, actually, at my school, it wasn't one of my teachers, but I remember some friends were very worried that the answer was right or wrong, and they had to interpret a Shakespeare play. And they were very disappointed that the answer that they gave wasn't one that the teacher shared. But then there'll be other teachers who'd really cultivate that, a bit like the Dead Poets Society scenario, but actually really bringing out that sort of creative and experimental side, and being, you know, when you're a young age, sometimes it's easy to either go with the flow or feel a little, as we were saying in sports, alienated from those people who had no problem being competitive and very sporty. And I found that I was given so much enthusiasm, obviously, but very much I was facilitated by particular teachers who were happy to say, well, you know, you've got, there's a spark, there's a creativity, there's an energy. Do something with that. Don't feel that you have to be beholden to a particular paradigm. And I really found that at university. Yeah. But I think that's what made me so inquisitive, the idea that it was okay to think outside of the box. Yeah. I think for me, humanities is definitely the right field for me. I don't think I would have worked so well in a more scientific where, you know, there is a different sort of methodology.
Well, I guess I'm sort of on the cusp, because in linguistics, you are either the most sciencey of the humanities disciplines, or you're the most humanities-like of the sciences, whichever way you want to look at it. Yeah. Again, you know, finding out that diversity of ways that you can research language. And I remember my first lecture in English language at university, and it was the lecturer who then subsequently became my PhD supervisor in the end, and just finding that absolutely inspiring, that you could think about and talk about sounds and write them down, you know, in such a precise way. I just thought that was genius.
And I found that my children are learning phonics in a way that I certainly didn't. I was always somebody who would break words apart. But actually, they're being taught by somebody who was at this university, you know, in English language linguistics. But it's so wonderful to see different models at work. And I just thought, this is not for me, or at least, you know, when I'm reading to my children of an evening sometimes, I do feel a bit apprehensive, because I think, well, I don't want to say anything that the teachers might be doing differently. But also I think, well, it all works out. The children will find their own way, and they do, inevitably.
Yeah, they're pretty resilient, aren't they?
Yeah, that's wonderful. What about other wider sort of cultural influences, or politics or religion, any other interests at university that you may have had, things that were going on in the background or the foreground?
Well, politics, I mean, it was an, it's an interesting period, isn't it? It's that whole period between the two independence referenda in Scotland, which went on for about 30 years. And there was a constant friction between what's happening in London politics and what's happening in Scottish politics. Of course, at the time, you didn't have the Scottish government. I almost can't imagine now not having that there, but likewise in Wales.
Absolutely. A Secretary of State with all that power, now an Assembly is equipped to deliver.
You know, completely different way of looking at things. I remember in my first job in Cambridge, I was given a lecture on the morning that, well, on the day that Margaret Thatcher had resigned, eventually. Yeah. And I do remember getting up and saying to them, I just want to share with you that, and they all stood up and applauded.
I remember that day. It was a Thursday, and of course the days before social media, and it was our English teacher who ran into the locker room, which was sort of the bridge, if you like, to the main sixth form common room, and he shouted, "She's gone, she's gone." And of course a few people probably, you know, thought, "What do you mean?" I thought, I think he means Margaret Thatcher. Yeah. And then it was coming up to lunchtime, and I went home and just to watch the 1 o'clock news, and just saw it unfold. And that was a momentous day, because I don't remember life before Margaret Thatcher. I was only five. I think the election was May 79, wasn't it? My birthday's in the June, so I don't remember life before a Conservative government. But I was then due my A-levels at the time that she went. So my whole life, it was almost as though I didn't know anything different.
And then when that shifted and you get the whole kind of things can only get better, you know, and I remember that too, you know, and again, you know, there I was giving a lecture in the morning
in
the Blair government.
it was a very sunny morning.
And you start to... that kind of, it's interwoven with what you're doing in your own life at the time. I mean, those are both post university, you know, but very, very, very little involvement in terms of, I've never been a kind of party member campaigning sort of politician. I think about the issues and I make my call depending on where we are. But it's massively important that you do, and I've always spoken to our children about the importance of getting out and voting, which I'm pleased to say they do.
And that's something which I think didn't happen. It was a very fallow period about 20 years ago when I know students weren't really voting. And I think it was probably the perception then that all politicians are the same. Whoever you vote for, you're going to get the same outcome. But of course, people are not saying that anymore. So that's one plus. And it's almost, absolutely. I mean, I certainly remember the early 80s. I was very young, but you know, politics was very divisive then. And then it stopped being quite so divisive, or it seemed a bit more cosmetically divisive. With the whole sort of big tent as different politicians were trying to encroach upon the centre ground.
But at least you could have the conversations in a way that you weren't immediately being written off because you were on that side, I suppose. Yeah. You know, it stopped being quite as partisan, I think, for at least a period.
Yeah.
But religion, no, not at the time. My personal faith came along later, but not when I was a student.
Yeah. And what about the radio, for example? Was that something that played a role?
Absolutely. I remember, so there was a request show on the radio in on a Saturday morning.
Junior Choice.
That's the one. And I remember listening avidly to that. We couldn't usually go to the cinema, but you could hear the music from the Disney films on, and you know, they were very much requested. I remember that, and I never wrote in myself, not that I remember anyway. I certainly never had anything played, but I would sit there hoping fervently that somehow, by some, you know, extraordinary means, the thing that I really wanted to hear being played would be played, even though I'd had no agency in that whatsoever.
And that programme came back when Radio 2 celebrated its 40th, and Radio 1, its 40th birthday in 2007. And then it returned every Christmas, and it's still on now, but with the original host until he passed away, Ed Stewart. And my last book, which was on Christmas, had a chapter on Junior Choice, and that was such an important part of my upbringing. And again, an example of how something which deals with music, which is very far from the mainstream, or music which is very, very perhaps has a very niche sort of market, generations of, well, children at the time, but now grandparents in many cases, still avidly listen to. And after Ed Stewart passed away, they brought the programme back after a year's hiatus. But very important. So it's,
Absolutely. You know, I remember that very well. And then I would be sitting doing my homework in the evenings at high school, and I'd have Radio 1 on.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily always my music, but it was what you did.
Yeah.
So I'd have Radio 1 on the background. And then I completely skipped 2 and 3 and became a Radio 4 listener, and I still wake up to the Today programme in the mornings and listen to that, you know, slightly decorous but still challenging sort of political conversation. So I do enjoy that. And then other than that, I listen to less than I should, to be honest. But there we are.
No, radio is very much the soundtrack of my life. And I remember it was before Wogan returned in 93, so the year before that, Brian Hayes did the Radio 2 breakfast show, and he was a very challenging figure. And I remember he was on holiday once, and I think it was Chris Stewart, and he interviewed Norman Fowler, or was talking to a correspondent about Norman Fowler, who was the chairman of the Conservative Party. It was the question of, you know, will John Major resign? And I remember thinking, this was on Radio 2 and it was the breakfast show, and I thought this was priceless. It was like the ideal programme, because you'd have the education, you'd have the current affairs, but also the music. And I thought, all crystallised in one programme. And I thought, that is what a perfect radio programme would be about. It sort of covers a wide constituency, and all, you know, it will reach out to various people. And it, I thought, was a style of broadcasting that has never quite been replicated since, but particularly at that time of morning, because obviously the Today programme is all talk, and the Radio 2 breakfast show, for example, is largely music, but also lots of quizzes. But there are ways, I think, of finding, there is a middle way.
Yeah. At least on that.
Yeah, in that regard, some more philosophically based questions. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive?
They're mixed. There's lots of positive things. My mum and I were very close, and I remember lots of good things. But also, my dad wasn't really around very much, but when he was, it wasn't always very happy. And so I remember some fairly epic bus stops. After he was gone, it was that was better. And then my mother died very suddenly when I was in my third year in university. And that was a terrible shock, and it left a massive gap. You know, I was married by then. We were both fairly decisive people. We got married at university. But it was a brilliant thing because I hang on to this fact that she knew I was settled and that we were going to look after each other, and it was fine. But it was only 6 months after we were married that she died, and it was very, very sudden, very unexpected. So there's a period after that I don't remember with any great affection, because there you are, you're still a student and everybody's going home. And of course, in a sense, you're married and you have got your home, but you can't go home. Home's not there anymore. There's just you. So that was not necessarily a happy time. And then when our eldest, we got three very cheery, pretty much grown-up children, but our eldest was born with quite serious congenital heart defects, and we were in hospital for about his first 6 months having surgery and whatnot. And again, that had its issues, and it wasn't always a time where you could see how that was going to come out. So I suppose peaks and troughs would be the description of the memories, but lots of good stuff, lots of good stuff. I think, you know, you do become a more positive person. You have to process all of that. It can feel very precarious.
Yeah, but it's easy to look back to that and perhaps single out particular periods as being particularly positive. But one of the great things about keeping a diary is that I can see realistically that there was never a period when I could say, oh, this. Also, I wouldn't be challenged if I could say, oh, it was blissful, everything was wonderful. It's like, well, but the whole point of education as well is to challenge and to think outside of the box. So you're always looking for a different avenue, a different way of thinking, you know, not being complacent. So there's always different levels of engagement. And I think, much as I look forward to the end of term and holiday sometimes, it's different. There's always a challenge around the corner. And I think that's the best period in anybody's life, when you've got the balance right. And often we don't get it right, when we can be sufficiently nurtured and feel safe and stable, but also feel that we have the capacity and the opportunity to think intellectually, to be erudite in our thinking, to ask difficult questions and be allowed to do so, and have that fostered in a suitable environment.
But also to process those things for yourself. So, you know, I'm a person with a personal faith. We're a Christian family now, but I still feel as if I've got my L plates up, because I became a Christian in my middle 30s, you know, a few years after the whole not very well heart baby incident. But it was when the children were starting to get ready to go to school, you know, and that kind of came to get me at that point. But it gives me a way now of processing some of those memories and dealing with all of that, without just having to go back and confront all of those all the time. You know, I can put those into a different kind of narrative for myself, and that's been really important for me.
It's certainly true, isn't it, that we all wear multiple hats, and sometimes we can find that, even when it comes to faith, that, you know, there are times when we are particularly aware of a particular faith position, or we might be going through a particular period when we're thinking very strictly about these things. But other times, when of necessity, we have to be more inverted commas secular in our thinking. And there's an area called implicit religion, which is very dear to me in my research. And I think that kind of encapsulates how a lot of people feel, that sense of commitment, that we all have to have multiple commitments at all times. And it's the same in any profession, any type of work. You know, we always have to do different things. We can't all sort of sit and, you know, do one job and do it all the time. But it makes us all the more, well, I suppose, more fulfilled as people for it.
Well, and also we are made to be questioning people, questioning creatures, aren't we? And, you know, as somebody who works on language and also works on how we got to be linguistic animals when other animals didn't get to be linguistic in the same way, that sort of evolutionary perspective, I think that is something that does set us apart, is that we can use language to talk about us using language and so on, and ask all of those questions. Yeah. So it's a natural condition, isn't it?
Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams you had when you were young? It sounds like you very much surpassed them, in the sense that you wouldn't have imagined being where you are today.
Well, no, you wouldn't. But then I wouldn't have known that there were creatures who did these sorts of jobs. You don't. I think even as a, certainly as an undergraduate, at the point where education was a lot less politicised, you know, in the early 80s, and I was on a grant, it was means tested, but we didn't have a bean, you know, so it was completely straightforward from that point of view. And I don't like the fact that the basis for that has changed for students now. But at the same time, I would much sooner have a higher education system where you have 50% going into higher education from school than 10%, yeah. which is about where it was when I left.
And I realised how privileged I was when I was at school, that so many of my friends, you know, as I did, went to university. But at university, I met many friends who told me that they were one of just a handful who either did A-levels or did from A-levels went on to university. So I didn't realise at the time just how privileged and how lucky I was.
Yeah. Yeah,
because I had nothing to compare it to.
Absolutely, and in the sense that did I fulfil my dreams? Well, I wanted out of there in a sense, and I got out of there, and all the doors that have opened. Which isn't to say you renounce your background, but that there were more things in the world that I wanted to be acquainted with, and I've managed to do that. And once you start being a sort of junior academic, there's things you want to do, you know, the keynotes at the international conferences and the books with the decent publishers and the research grants and the teaching a course that really works and the supervising PhD students who surpass you. And I've been really, really fortunate. I've done all of that. So in that sense, you know, yes, but actually in the sense that would I have thought that I'd be here? Well, no, but then I wouldn't have known that here existed in the sense of roles in leadership in universities or in anything else, to be honest. I didn't have any experience of that kind of a job that was above basically transactional, which would have been what my mother did.
Yeah. And two more questions. Are you in touch with friends from your past?
Yes. Well, gosh, which past? Yeah.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because we all have different
networks.
And layers.
Yeah. University friends, some of whom I was at school with, some folks at who were university friends who are still really close friends. So from there, yes. From primary school, from that kind of period, no. But then I moved away when I started high school, and it would be difficult in those days before social media, when you didn't even have a phone, not in the house, not even a mobile one, you'd have had to be pretty motivated to keep those contacts.
And social media does facilitate that, but for good and for ill sometimes. And, you know, it's sometimes that we all move, we all grow up in different ways, but sometimes we find that we are just the same people that we were. But in other respects, we've moved in different directions. So I think it's all part of growing up, isn't it? Yeah. And my last question is, would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, definitely a looking forward person. I mean, I don't avoid looking back, but where things were painful, I really don't see what benefit there is in dwelling on them. And you try and take things from those times and build on them, so you've already taken what you're going to be able to take positively. So definitely looking forward. But that doesn't mean you don't enjoy where you are now. I think it's really important just to sit back and enjoy little things, as well as, and I think, you know, as somebody who is has always been in various respects quite an ambitious person, it's really important to sit back and say, I'm just going to read a novel and really enjoy that, or have a conversation with somebody and really enjoy that, you know, and that's fine too.
April and Marl, it's been wonderful to catch up with you this afternoon. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.